Do you understand all the implications of the right to self-defense and the right to keep and bear arms? Well, if you think you do or you think you don't, stay with us for Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. As you listen to this, we are in the process of wrapping up Camp American for 2015. And so obviously this is pre-recorded because I am in Angola, Indiana, rapidly packing up and getting ready to come home so we can go into the studio and do a show for next week. I'm going to invite you, if you didn't listen last week, to go out to our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com, and listen to the first part of the presentation that's being given today. This presentation was given by Pastor David Whitney, who is the chief instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, and he is also a pastor of Cornerstone Evangelical Free Church in Pasadena, Maryland. This is not exactly new to him. He has been talking on these subjects for a number of years, both in his constitution class and from the pulpit in his church. What he's giving a rundown on is a kind of an expansion on what he did last week. Last week he did a class, and again, this is a class from Camp American. So if you're interested in the video of this, let me know. Contact us by email. You can find us at principledpolicy.com. Or you can also look at campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. Pastor Whitney is going to be talking an expansion of what the implications are of the right of self-defense and the right to keep and bear arms, which is part and parcel of the right of self-defense. And we're talking in terms of how that right implies certain things. I have been taken aback recently by some of the new tactics being used by the people who would very much like to grab and ban all guns. And some of the things that they like to say are simply beyond comprehension as far as their disingenuousness and simple dishonesty. And by that, I mean, for instance, I've seen a number of headlines that the new tack being taken by a number of anti-gun types is the idea that the right to personal ownership of a weapon, the individual right to own a weapon, was only invented in 2008 by the Supreme Court. This is the silliest thing I've ever heard in my life, and it's made silly by the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, what do I mean by it makes it silly? Okay, let's talk about this for a second, because I think Pastor Whitney's also going to go into more depth than I'm going to, but I'm going to read to you the Second Amendment to the Constitution, and this is also pursuant to a couple of online discussions I've had recently with people who would very much like to see the federal government regulate gun ownership. Here is Article 2, or the Second Amendment of the Bill of Rights. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. There are a number of things in there. For instance, one of the bones of contention is that the idea that there is no individual right to own guns comes from this word, the militia, that in fact people have been arguing for quite some time that really what's happened here is that the Constitution only gives the right for the state to have it in the form of the National Guard. Well, there's a problem with that. The National Guard only goes back to about 1909. And so who were the militia before that? Well, the militia was the militia. And what the militia was and continues to be actually is every able-bodied person who is privately armed. And in fact, it was a requirement in the early days of the Republic that every able-bodied man, and that is expanded now to women as well. And women do not have the right to keep and bear arms simply because they can't be called into service by the state. But every able-bodied man between usually about 16 and 55 or 60, depending on what state you were in, was required to own a gun and was required to come out for training on occasion. Now, why were they required to do that? Well, that's what this is all about, being necessary to the security of a free state. The security of a free state is guaranteed by the armed members of those people who are willing to come out and defend it. That's what the militia was all about. Now, who were they going to be defended from? Well, foreign invaders, internal insurrection, even external invasion from neighbors. In the United States of America, that hasn't always been a problem, but there have been incursions by one state into another state. Maybe you've heard of a little something called the Toledo War. If you don't know that, I'd do a Wikipedia search on the Toledo War, but essentially Ohio got Toledo and the strip that goes across the northern part of northwestern Ohio, and Michigan lost that territory. There was a dispute there, and actually got the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in return as a concession by the federal government. So, is there such a thing as the possibility of having to defend your state against the invasion of a neighbor? Yeah, I'd say it's pretty well passed. That's not the point. The right of the people to keep and bear arms. Well, who are the people? If the people aren't individuals, then this is the only right in the entire Bill of Rights that is not written to the individual, but is written to some kind of a nebulous body, usually considered to be the state. Which is a kind of a ridiculous argument. All of a sudden, the Bill of Rights goes from guaranteeing individual rights to guaranteeing. And remember that the federal government does not give rights. The federal government guarantees rights. Government does not give rights. And when I say the federal government, I really mean all government. Government does not give rights. The purpose of government, and this is one of the things we always teach and emphasize and institute on the Constitution, is that government protects rights. It doesn't give rights. So when we hear that the Supreme Court created a right or the Congress created a right, no such right. If the right didn't already exist and the Congress did not guarantee it, then it's a made-up thing. And it is not constitutional. Keep that in mind. Why are we so sure about this well-regulated militia thing? You know, a lot of people point to that and say, well, regulation. Okay. In the context that they're talking about regulation in, this has to do with training and arming the militia. If you go back to Article 1, Section 8, it's very clear that Congress has the power, and I'm going to quote from Article 1, Section 8, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline described by Congress. In other words, Congress has the right to tell the states how to train the militia. They have the right to set the kind of weapons the militia will have to have. And you could argue from this vantage point that Congress has the responsibility of making sure that every able-bodied person is armed with the weapons they want them to have and that they are in their personal possession. Now, no one has gone that far, but it is one of the implications that is laid out in Article 1, Section 8 in agreement with Article 2 of the Bill of Rights, or the Second Amendment, as it's known. And I think Dave Whitney's going to get into some of this today. So I don't want to take up any of his time. So I'm going to bail out here, and I'm going to let him take it. And I will close out after David Whitney talking about the implications of the right of self-defense and the Second Amendment.
Talk, we've laid the theological foundation, the biblical justification to keep and bear arms, and I hope that you have that clearly in your mind now. And again, if there's anything that's still fuzzy in your mind, I'd love to clarify that, but I hope those scriptures are really helpful. So we're going to step from looking at the biblical foundation of the right to keep and bear arms to how our system of government structured the involvement of weapons and citizens. So it's important to understand that the militia was viewed by our founders not as an optional thing, not as some nice little tangential item that if you had it is nice, if you didn't have it, that's okay. They viewed the militia as absolutely necessary to the preservation of free government. In Maryland, our Maryland Declaration of Rights reads this way, that a well-regulated militia is the proper and natural defense of a free government, which says if you do not have a militia, you do not have a free government. Free, by the way, isn't an indication of how much you pay for it. It's not that it's free, you don't pay anything for it. Free means a government that preserves liberty for the people. And if you don't have liberty, you don't have a militia. So a militia is not a side thing. It's absolutely essential. And that's exactly what the Second Amendment says as well. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Is it optional? Is it optional according to the Second Amendment? No, it is necessary. And notice it uses the same phrase, free government in the Maryland Declaration of Rights, free state in the U.S. Constitution. The whole idea of having a government that preserves your liberty means that a militia is absolutely necessary. It is not an option. Now again, today, if you talk about militias at all, and I know this from experience of, you know, talking and teaching about it, you're considered a domestic terrorist. You're a Timothy McVeigh. You're one of these guys who's running around in the woods. You're a danger to free government is what most people believe today if you talk about the word militia. And that is because the left knows that a disarmed people, as we shared before, what does a tyrant do once he disarms people? One of two things. What is it? He kills them or he enslaves them. One of two things the tyrant's going to do. A free government, that is a government that preserves your liberty and does not enslave you, requires a militia. Free Defense Force, that's good. However, the term militia itself is a good term, a term that's in our founding documents and obviously not an option at all. With the history behind the militia concept goes all the way back in English common law. Alfred the Great, who is probably the one that crafted and put together what became English common law more than any of the other rulers of England. Alfred the Great, 871 to 899, required that all able-bodied men purchase weapons and be available for military duty. They purchased them with their own dime, and they had to be ready for military duty at any time. So they had to keep their weapons, maintain their weapons, and be ready to use, that is, to be trained to use those weapons for military duty. In fact, Alfred fined you as a man if you didn't have the proper weapons, and if those weapons were not in proper working order, you were fined because you were not properly prepared to be the member of the militia that you were required. So if the Second Amendment protects only the collective right of the state to maintain a police force, which again is what the left will tell you, the Second Amendment only protects the collective right, it doesn't protect your individual right to keep and bear arms. But if that were the case, the Second Amendment would be completely out of place in a Bill of Rights, which protects individual rights in every other thing. Consider for a minute the First Amendment. Let's just take, freedom of the press out of the First Amendment and say, if the Bill of Rights is only talking about the collective right for the government to do something, collectively to do something, then the freedom of the press would only give who the right to publish? The government. You would have no right to publish. So you'd be like under the Soviet Union, Pravda, the government organ that pumps out propaganda. You would never have the right to publish your own articles. You would never have a right to put a blog up on the internet. Everything would have to come from the government. But we know that that's a false interpretation of the First Amendment. First Amendment protects your individual right to keep and bear arms, to freedom of the press and freedom of speech. So the Second Amendment protects your individual right to keep and bear arms as well. Our founders were very clear that they saw that individual ownership of firearms as a protection of freedom against both foreign invasion, that's where we need the militia to be able to protect us when a foreign army comes, and freedom against domestic tyranny, that is, when your own government turns on you as the people and decides that you're the enemy, we need to be able to protect against that. And that's the second reason for the Second Amendment. Era 15. Very good. Good sight there, because that is a truncated picture. It's hard to see all of that weapon. George Washington said this, firearms stand next and important to the Constitution itself. They are American people's liberty teeth, keystone under independence. And the rest of this quote, I'm not so sure it's from, it's probably not from Washington, so the rest of it is a bit of a addition that someone has made. To secure peace, security, and happiness, the rifle and pistol, and Washington wouldn't have said rifle, which is why the rest of this quote probably isn't from him. But anyway, are equally indispensable. The very atmosphere of firearms everywhere restrains evil interference. They deserve a place of honor with all that is good. And so if Washington didn't say the rest of that, nonetheless, the rest of that is true. Our framers saw the importance of firearms. Samuel Adams, who's often called the father of our war for independence, the Constitution shall never be construed to prevent the people of the United States who are peaceable citizens from keeping their own arms. Never. That was what they understood the document to mean. Noah Webster, I think, very, very cogently said this: before a standing army or a tyrannical government can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every kingdom in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular or professional troops that can be on any pretense raised in the United States. You see, our founders understood they didn't want a standing army because standing armies are always the toy thing of tyrants, and they will use the standing army to oppress the people and to abuse the people's God-given rights. Instead, you want a militia, which is the citizens themselves. And in that day, when Webster wrote those words, he understood that even if the government, even if the federal government raised an army, they had a greater army in the people, the body of the citizens, than any army that the government could raise. And therefore, if the battle was confronted between the militia and the regular army, who would win? According to Webster, the militia would win. And why? They had superior force. Superior force. That means they had the weapons that the soldiers would have. They didn't have some little, you know, toy pop gun. They had the weapons that the soldiers themselves would have. They had equal, not equal. He said they had superior weapons to the weapons that an army, a standing army, would have. Webster's Dictionary, 1828, by the way, if you don't know that, that's the dictionary to look to if you want to understand the words as they were understood and what those words meant at the founding era. Webster said that a militia is the body of soldiers in a state enrolled for discipline but not engaged in actual service except in emergencies, as distinguished from regular troops whose sole occupation is war or military service. The militia of a country are the able-bodied men organized into companies, regiments, and brigades with officers of all grades and required by law to attend military exercises on certain days only, but at other times left to pursue their usual occupations. So the militia, by definition, is not what the left have twisted it into meaning today. The militia is all of the able-bodied male citizens, usually above the age of 16, early in history, but above the age of 18, and usually from 18 to some places 45, some places 55, and some places even up to 60. Barry. Mm-hmm.
But that's not the same thing.
That's right, and I will point that out later because many people will tell you, oh yeah, we have a militia in our country and it's the National Guard. We'll see that that is not the case. Let me just use Maryland's Constitution as well because it clearly says not only in the Declaration of Rights but in the body of the Constitution, the General Assembly shall make from time to time provisions for organizing, equipping, and disciplining the militia as the exigency may require. In other words, they're supposed to be giving military-grade weapons to the members of the state militia, not saying you can't have arms, but saying, no, not only must you have arms, we're going to see that you do have those arms. We're going to give them to you, and we're going to spend taxpayers' dollars to be certain you've got those military-grade weapons. And then it goes on to say, and pass such laws to promote volunteer militia organizations as may afford them effectual encouragement. Our state government is doing the exact opposite of this every single year. Instead of encouraging, it's saying you cannot own these certain weapons, and furthermore, if you act in a fashion as a militia, you are in trouble with the state government of Maryland. Now, some people will argue this question just brought up about the National Guard. Is the National Guard the militia? An important question. But we need to look at the history of the National Guard. Yes.
Federal
Yes, government. The federal government controls it. National Guard Status Act of 1933 made the National Guard a component of the Army. So very clearly, no longer some separate entity that could be called a militia. They made it part of the Army itself. 1933 Legislative Act amending the National Defense Act of 1916 provided that those who enlisted in the state National Guard unit simultaneously enlisted in the National Guard of the United States and thereby became deployable assets of the U.S. Army. No longer really under the control of the governor, which is the structure. We're going to look at the structure of the militia. The militia is under the control of the governor. An illustration happened a few years ago of why this doesn't work now that the National Guard has been nationalized. The governor of Montana, at the time they were having a lot of wildfires one summer, he was begging George Bush II to bring the National Guard troops from Montana back to Montana from Iraq to help out with the crisis in his state of these wildfires that were spreading across the state. You know what Bush told him? No way. Those are not your troops. They're mine. You're not getting them back at all. I'm paraphrasing Bush II, but that's essentially what he said. Because of this act said, no. You are now under the United States National Guard, which is really a deployable asset of the U.S. Army. So why do we call it a National Guard? It's just smoke and mirrors. It's really part of the Army. It's no longer somewhat in any way, shape, or form a militia. Then people will say, well, wait a minute. There's still aspects that the National Guard is. Well, the total force policy of 1973 required all active and reserved military organizations. By the way, that would include the National Guard. All active and reserved military organizations be treated as a single integrated force. Those are their words, not mine. So you cannot argue that any part of the National Guard is still a militia in any way, shape, or form. No, it is an integrated force with the rest of the military. And that, if you're looking at the, you want to look up the ARNG, army.mil, et cetera, the history is there if you're interested in that. By our founders' definition of the current National Guard, it is not a militia as referred to by our Constitution, U.S. Constitution, or state Constitution. In fact, I trust the word of a great constitutional scholar, Dr. Ed Vieira. He says, not one of the 50 states in the Union today has a true constitutional militia. Not one. They have things that might be called such, but none of them are true constitutional militias. Now, in Maryland, people to say, wait a minute, we've got this organization called the Maryland Defense Force. Isn't that the militia? Okay, the National Guard, you're telling me, is not, but there's and other states have very similar things, so-and-so defense force. But the MDF is a, and this is their own words, not mine, voluntary uniformed state military agency and one of the four components of the Maryland Military Department. So you look at that and say, well, that sounds kind of like a militia, right? The primary mission, though, of that is providing competent and supplemental professional, technical, and military support to the Maryland Army National Guard, the Maryland Air National Guard, and the Maryland Emergency Management Agency. It is not a militia. Its description of its own clearly states that it is not. It is actually part of the standing army. If you read our Declaration of Rights, and again, this is from the Maryland Constitution, as well as the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence said one of the reasons, one of the 28 reasons we separated from Great Britain is exactly this. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. Notice the qualification there. It wasn't that there could never be a standing army, but if there were to be a standing army, who had to approve of that standing army? State legislature. If the state legislature did not approve a standing army, there could be no standing army, and King George III had done this repeatedly. Our Maryland Constitution says that standing armies are dangerous to liberty, and all of our founders believe this. They warned that standing armies would be used by tyrants. Standing armies are dangerous to liberty and ought not to be raised up or kept without the consent of the legislature. See the same connection? If there's going to be a standing army, state legislature has to be the one that approves of that before it actually is allowed to exist. Article 1, Section 8 of our U.S. Constitution says one of the powers that we the people have granted to Congress is to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that usage shall be for a longer term than 2 years. So which branch of the federal government makes the decision about raising an army or armies? Which branch? Does anybody know your Constitution well enough to know where this article comes? Which of the first three articles this is in? Dealing with what branch of government? The legislative. So the same thing we saw with the Declaration of Independence, it's the legislature that has to make the decision if there's going to be a standing army, and they only have 2 years to make that decision, and then they have to renew that decision every 2 years if there is to be a standing army, because they did not trust standing armies. They knew they were dangerous to liberties. They had always been dangerous to liberty. So the federal army was to be composed by our founders of the several state militias. That is, there was no standing army, but if there was an emergency, then the militias of the several states were called together by Congress, the legislative branch at the federal level, called together those militias to form an army at the time that the emergency was occurring and it was needed. And those militias of the several states actually have a lower component level, that is the posse comitatus of the county. That the state militia structure said that on the county level, there is another structure called the posse that is kind of the lowest level organization militarily for our society. And they structured these three levels. The posse, together, the posses of each of the counties would form the state militia. The state militias, when called up by the federal legislature, then would form the army, but there would never be a standing army in our land, because they knew if there's a standing army, that army ultimately will be used by tyrants to destroy your liberties. When's the last time in America? Does anybody know the last time we had a true army that followed this pattern? That is, it was called up by the legislature, the federal legislature, and they commissioned it to do a specific task for a 2-year period. War of 1812, it's a little bit later than that. Anybody else? What war? Mexican War, yes, but later than that. Civil War, later than that. World War I, later than that. World War II was the last time our federal legislature had a true declaration of war where they were calling up the state militias, at least on paper. By that time, of course, the National Guard already exists. Some of the destruction of our structure had already begun. But since World War II, how many wars? Can somebody name some of the wars we've been involved with since World War II? Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq 1, Iraq 2, Desert Storm, blah, 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 blah. All those things, are they constitutional? They were conducted by a standing army. In other words, prior to World War II, yes, there were times when there were standing armies, World War I, but they were disbanded at the end of World War I. But at the end of World War II, America shifted from a constitutional republic. We're still a constitutional republic on paper. But in practice, we shifted from a constitutional republic to an empire. An empire with a standing army. Because since World War II, the army has not been disbanded in spite of the fact that the legislature is no longer doing its job as described by our Constitution. Article 2, Section 2 of our Constitution says the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States. And when are they called into the actual service of the United States? When? And who declares the war? Congress. So the legislative branch has to declare the war before the President becomes the Commander-in-Chief. You could say the President is only the Commander-in-Chief in waiting. That is, he has no function as Commander-in-Chief until the legislature says, we're declaring war and we're calling up the militia. The legislature calls up the militia, not the President. It's only after the militia is called up by the legislature to form the army that then and only then can they be put into actual service. Article 1, Section 8, here's the details. To declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, make rules concerning captures on land and water, to provide for the calling forth the militia. Again, this is the legislative branch. Congress does this. To execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such parts of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. And when can they be employed in the service of the United States? What has to happen? Congress has to declare war. Congress has to take the action before they're brought up to that level. Otherwise, they're under the governor of each of the states as state militias. And then finally, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the Congress. So notice the power given to the state governments here. Who chooses the officers? State governments choose the officers in all ranks up to what's called general. General is that they're over more than just a state militia. So all the ranks of all the officers other than generals were to be in the hands of the state militia. So colonels and lieutenants and captains, all the other ranks were to be decisions made by the state government because the state governments were in control of the militia. The militia was under them, not under the federal government, except when a war was called up. Our Maryland Constitution echoes this. The governor shall be the commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces of the state and may call out the militia to repel invasions, suppress insurrections, and enforce the execution of the laws, but shall not take the command in person without the consent of the legislature. So if the governor of our state, or your state probably has a very similar statement in its constitution, if the governor of the state is to take control of the militia, who has to act before the governor takes control? Who? The state legislative branch. So until the state legislative branch gives him permission, the governor, although he's the head of the militia of the state, cannot utilize the power of the militia of the state unless the legislature approves. He shall take care, this is his job, that the laws are faithfully executed. So we have a situation our founders designed in order to prevent a standing army of very powerful checks against the use of military force, the militia. The federal army is composed of militias of the several states. Those are to be composed of the posse comitatus of each of the counties. And the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, can only use the militias when there's a declaration of war by Congress. So the legislative branch is a check against abuse of power on the part of the president in using the state militias. And the militias themselves of the several states are composed of the posse comitatus, but the governor of the state himself cannot use the militia willy-nilly. He has to get permission and consent of the state legislature, in our case, Maryland General Assembly, before the posse comitatus of each county can be utilized by him as the governor. See this? They distrusted a standing army so much that they would not allow anyone except one individual, we're going to talk about that individual in a moment, except one individual to have direct connection and direct rule over the military power in the militia, or in this case, in the posse comitatus. Devin, could you come up here for a minute? So let's look at it this way. If we were to visualize that the militia is the sword itself, okay? That's the militia. But the militia is always in the scabbard. Come on over here. The tyrant-in-chief at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue says, oh, I'm going to go bomb somebody or other. I'm going to go to war against somebody or other. And he goes to take the militia.
Stop.
Right. And who says stop? Which branch of government?
The
legislature. The legislature says, no, no, no. You're only going to pull the militia out to use the militia if the legislature has approved taking the sword out of the scabbard. Likewise, if the governor of my state or your state says, hey, I'm going to use the power of the militia, and I think there's an emergency here, I'm going to go pull that power of the militia out.
Stop.
Why? That's right. And you are the legislature. Thank you, Devin. Thank you for your help. So there's only one individual in the structure our founders established that is free to pull the power of the sword, the power of the militia, out of the scabbard without the approval of the legislative branch, and that is the county sheriff. The county sheriff alone has the power of the posse comitatus, in which he can employ the force of the citizens of his county who are keeping and bearing arms for this very purpose. If there's a problem in his community, if there's a disturbance of the peace that he sees that he and his deputies are insufficient to handle, he needs immediately to pull the power of the sword, the power of the posse, to deal with that problem. And he does not have to appeal to the legislature or the legislative branch of the county to ask for permission to pull the sword from the scabbard. He can do it immediately. And he is accountable for the use of that power. Therefore, he is the chief law enforcement officer in his county because he is the one that the people have entrusted with that kind of power, where when we talk about the governor, we're not going to trust him that power directly. No, no, no. We're going to be sure the governor has a check on his power, the legislative branch. The president, no, he doesn't have that power directly. There's a check upon his use of the state militias. He cannot do it directly. This is a powerful structure that our founders wisely made in empowering the sheriff with that power alone. Barry. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And at the local level for the sheriff of the county to approve that call up by
Amen.
The legislature.
Right. So
that's another check even on the legislative branches.
Yes.
As to whether or not they've done anything wise.
Right. So the executive branches at each level have a check on the higher level that if they say, hey, you're going to go declare war. I think of an example here where Pennsylvania, when Lincoln called up for 75,000 troops to attack the South, there was a troop response from Pennsylvania that invaded Maryland, if I remember, is like Mount Airy. I'm a little vague on exactly where. But anyway, they invaded, and the Marylanders, you know, came face to face with the militia from Pennsylvania and militia from Maryland and said, hey, we don't want to fight you guys. We have no qualms and no quarrels with you at all. And you know what? The Pennsylvania boys went home. They said, we don't care. Mr. Lincoln's calling something that we don't believe is righteous or right, and so we're going home. And they did. They went home. But not the Massachusetts boys. They came on April 19th through Baltimore, and the transition from one train station on one side of town to the other train station on the other side of town in order to go south involved the citizens of Baltimore saying, we don't like what you're doing. Uh-uh. You're doing wrong. And they began to pick up bricks and throw, and there was the massacre of Baltimore with first blood shed in the war to prevent Southern independence. But you see, what was taking place there, there were certain elements that said, no, we don't care if the president has said this. He's wrong. And we're a check upon his power to just pull the sword out willy-nilly and go murder anybody he pleases.
And just a second thought, and you can, whether this is right or not, having the posse comitatus is made up of the citizenry of the county you're in, if the legislature would call them up illegitimately or for a tyrannical purpose, they also have a secondary check in that those people are also probably voters.
Yes.
Vote
them out. Yep. And that was the purpose why it was only 2 years at the federal level. In other words, if there was a call for a declaration of war, it had to last 2 years. And you know what would happen within that 2 years to every one of those congressmen that voted for it, House of Representatives that voted for it? They would stand for election. And that election would be a referendum on the war that they had just declared. So within 2 years, the check of the people at the voting booth upon the people who declared war would take place. And if they wanted to get rid of the warmongers and put people in who are not warmongers, the war could come to an end in that 2 year period. So you're right. The voters at the local level could replace the governor. They could replace the legislatures. And they had the power of the ballot box to prevent the kind of tyranny that could be conducted. Yes. Right. If you want to get rid of the peaceniks when there should be a time to go to war, again, the ballot box can accomplish that. This is a very powerful structure. And our founders were very wise recognizing this power of the sword ought to be kept in the sheath at all times. We're not a warlike people. We don't go around the world seeking monsters to destroy. No. We are a peace-loving people, and we don't want war, and we don't want to pull that sword unless it's absolutely necessary. And in order to prevent tyrannical people using the power of the sword, we put all of these checks into place. The commander-in-chief is checked by the Congress, and the governor is checked by the state legislature, all the way down to the local sheriff. And of course, if the local sheriff begins acting erratically and doing things with a posse comitatus that he ought not to be doing, what would happen to him? 4 years, there'd be an election, or less than 4 years, and replace that sheriff with one who will be a true peace officer as sheriff.
That's the reason why, when you think about it, if a move is made in your state to make your sheriff an appointed office, you should fight.
Very bad. Very bad. In our county, that's one of the fights in our county. Years ago, in the 30s, they decided to have a professional police force rather than the sheriff. And so they began to strip away the powers of the sheriff to today. The county police chief is an appointed official, which means he's a political hack. And it's very interesting to see what's happened in our county in that political hack over the past, let's see, we've had three police chiefs now over the past six years, something like that. What happened to the first police chief? He was involved in corruption with the one who had appointed him. The county executive had appointed him, and he used the police officers for his political campaign. He told police officers to go out and tear up the signs of his opponent. What? And the police officers said, well, I guess if I keep, I got to keep my jobs, I got to do what I'm told, even though this does not sound like right police work. And things like that. There's a whole list of things. So finally, the county executive was put on trial. He went to jail for 6 months. But you know what the police chief got? He got a golden parachute. Nice retirement plan. Yeah, very, very wonderful. Next police chief in, he was corrupt, and I forget all the details of his corruption. He got another golden parachute, and he was nicely retired. And we got another. But it's the same problem. It's an appointed official, and the power of the police is based upon a political appointment rather than upon the election of the people choosing their sheriff, who's the chief law enforcement officer. And I'm praying my friend Joe, who's running for sheriff, can change that, because legally, we studied all the details. They didn't legally make any changes. They just did it. Instead of amending the Constitution or amending the county charter, they just created this new police force and said it has all these powers, and the sheriff, his powers are stripped down to nothing. Well, if a proper sheriff is elected, a constitutional sheriff, he can restore all those powers, including the posse comitatus of our county, which would be really, really exciting. We've got the worst county in the union in terms of the Fourth Amendment. So our county has the world's biggest spy agency, NSA, is the biggest employer in our county. And they're breaking the law every single day. Well, I won't go any further because I don't know if they're listening or they got the, you know, anyway. They probably are listening in by some means or another. So, but this design was to prevent a standing army from ever happening, and only to be used in the very, very limited times when it was absolutely necessary to draw the sword and involve oneself in battles, either in defense of our country or battles that involve defense of a particular state government. Instead, what has former mayor of Baltimore, now the governor of Maryland, what has he done? He has disarmed the posse in Maryland, this one particular bill. There's a 3-year imprisonment or $5,000 fine, and I don't have it on me currently, but for carrying a clip that holds 17 rounds instead of a clip that holds 10 rounds, 3 years in prison, $5,000 fine. Law enforcement unit may seize as contraband and dispose of, according to regulation, an assault pistol, transported, sold, transferred, purchased, received, possessed, violation of this subtitle, on and on the list goes of the tyrannical gun grab. Because the governor knows that this structure, tyranny can only prevail when this structure is taken apart piece by piece, that there is no county sheriff, that there is no posse comitatus of the people of the county who are armed, that there is no true militia of the several states. Maryland's been stripped of that. And all of this has to be taken apart and a standing army at the federal level established in order for there to be absolute tyranny. And he is part of that problem, which is probably why he's running for president in the future. Anyway, William Blackstone, who was the law writer for, or law teacher for our founders, said this, Book 1, Chapter 9, Section 467, he, the sheriff, is also to defend his county against any of the king's enemies when they come into the land, and for this purpose, as well as for keeping the peace and pursuing felons, he may command all the people of his county, there's the posse comitatus, all the people of his county to attend him, which is called the posse comitatus, or the power of the county, which summons every person above 15 years old and under the degree of a peer is bound to attend upon warning under pain of fine and imprisonment. That is, if you didn't show up for the posse and the sheriff called you, you could be put in prison, you could be fined for your failure to do your duty as a citizen who is part of the posse comitatus. Yes. Everybody has a gun and everybody gets away with everything?
Oh? Always get away with everything, and everybody else has a gun.
Some Westerns do, but other Westerns present, there's only a few deputies, there's a sheriff, and he's got a few deputies. If there's a problem, what's he do? He calls up a posse, and everybody's got a gun. Well, some Westerns are designed with a message contrary to this, but some of the older Westerns are designed with the idea that the sheriff always uses his posse. He always uses his posse when there's a real threat. because he's only got a couple deputies. There isn't many deputies in his jurisdiction, but the posse is all the able-bodied citizens. And so Black's Law Dictionary, because people say, well, Blackstone is kind of old. That's, you know, we're not following that anymore. Well, let's look at a law dictionary of our day. Posse Comitatus, third edition, Black's. The Latin is the power or the force of the county, the entire population of a county above the age of 15, which a sheriff may summon to his assistance in certain cases as to aid him in keeping the peace and pursuing and arresting felons, etc. So the posse is still legally on the books as a potential for every county in our nation. Black's Law Dictionary, third edition, militia. The body of citizens in a state enrolled for discipline as a military force, but not engaged in actual service except in emergencies, as distinguished from a regular troops or a standing army. So look there. The definition hasn't changed. Legally, we could still have true state militias in our land, in spite of the fact that we currently do not. And indeed, until we restore this structure in our land, our founders warned us that we will not maintain a free government, that is, a government that truly protects our God-given rights and our liberties. Instead, if this is not restored, we will see increasing tyranny, and we will not have the power to stop that tyranny because we will be disarmed and we will be unable to do that work. I'm very encouraged by what Sheriff Mack is doing around the country with Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. Do you have your shirt on? Stand up for a second, Ronnie. Turn around so people can see the back of your shirt. Ronnie is a member of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association.org, an organization where they're training peace officers such as Ronnie and training sheriffs to do this duty that our founders constructed. The county sheriff, Richard Mack, said, is the last line of defense when it comes to upholding and defending the Constitution. And so when we go to elect a sheriff, it is probably the most important election at the local level, even at the state level, the most important election, because if you have a sheriff who understands this and who's willing and ready to begin building again the structure that our founders put in place to prevent tyranny and to prevent a standing army, you can see a restoration happen at your local level. And I'm very excited about this campaign, my friend Joe in Anne Arundel County, because if he becomes elected sheriff, he's going to begin implementing changes to restore this structure, to rebuild the posse, and to rebuild the kind of constitutional militia that is going to defend our God-given liberties. Questions or comments that you might have? Is this brand new to you, or is this something that recalls other things that you've been taught? Comments or questions? Yes.
I guess it just has blown me away hearing you talk about Maryland and the laws that they have been making, and I was wondering if that's happening in other states too, or if it's just Maryland.
Yes, many other states. Illinois, one of the other really bad states in terms of gun grabbing. Connecticut, very bad. Connecticut has eliminated all of its sheriffs. There is not one sheriff in the state of Connecticut altogether. And that's why I think what happened there, now well, we go into details as what happened and why, but they're trying to make a point. Oh, look, you know, we got to take guns away from people or these shootings will happen. So there are states, some that are worse than Maryland, but there are many states that are putting forth egregious violations of our Constitution. I don't know exactly the situation in Ohio or Indiana. Perhaps some locally here could give us some information about what's happening on that grounds here.
Ohio has one county with an appointed sheriff.
One.
Okay.
So it's starting.
There's push on.
Cuyahoga County. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cleveland, folks.
Yes. Question or comment, and then Ricky?
I was just saying, I could tell you kind of a little bit about the guns here in Indiana.
Oh, yeah, tell me what the situation is in Indiana.
We can have them just about anywhere except for the workplace.
Okay. So you can carry open and concealed?
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Exactly about that part. But I know we can have them in the workplace.
Workplace restrictions. Yeah, Ricky, and then we'll go. Go ahead this way, and then well, either way. Yeah.
Yeah, we encourage our Constitution students to contact their sheriffs and give them Sheriff Mack's book, County Sheriff America's Last Hope. First of all, to educate them about what their true duty is. And secondly, we get a lot of our students that actually write or call their sheriffs and ask them questions about, you know, if Obama issues executive orders that tells you to confiscate the weapons of the citizens, would you do that? And even the sheriffs that say that, oh, we're pro-Second Amendment, come back and say things like, well, we can't pick and choose which laws we adhere to. And so we use that as educational opportunities then to tell them the law is the Second Amendment, not what an executive order says. But my point is, bring it up, give them books, ask them those questions, because they don't know that they don't know.
Right, right. We need to educate our sheriffs. And one of the things that can educate a sheriff real powerfully is somebody running a campaign against them, pointing out all the unconstitutional things they've done. And even if you don't win that campaign, the sheriff who's fighting for re-election is really, oh, wait a minute, uh-oh, I better change my behavior and my tactics because I'm getting attacked on these constitutional issues. So you can make an impact even if you don't win a campaign.
I just kind of wanted to, I don't know if this is happening in like other people's schools, but at my high school, I'm graduated now, but like just this year we had a police officer, like a school police officer, just basically standing in our lobby all day as if that's going to like be able to protect the entire school or something. Probably a lot more effective if, you know, teachers were allowed to have
to keep and bear arms. I mean,
like, there's just one cop with one gun in the middle of the lobby, and that's like that's all we have. So I thought that was a pretty kind of silly way of trying to make us feel protected or something.
Yep, very good. And then there was one back there.
They call him a resource officer.
Resource officer. Mm.
Why did they take our America's and militia's guns away?
They're taking it away, I believe, for two purposes, either to enslave us or to murder us. Those are the only two reasons they take guns away from law-abiding citizens. Yep, those two purposes.
Exactly what she said about the executive order.
Yes.
My sheriff said if he gets one, he will not do it.
Very good. We applaud such sheriff. He ought to be praised. And
he's your favorite. He's one of your favorites.
Yeah, very good. Oh, Brad Rogers is your sheriff. Well, I applaud him because Brad has taken some bold stands against federal tyranny, and he's won. I don't know if we have time just to mention that.
We tried to make a slot for him to speak, and we just couldn't fit it in.
Yeah, because he's taken some bold stands, and it's been successful. Let me just tell that story if anybody doesn't know it. There was a dairy farmer, horror of horrors, doing something that is absolutely devastating and dangerous, selling raw milk, unpasteurized milk. Oh, horrors, horrors, you know. And there was five federal agencies been trying to shut this farmer down, going on his property, invading and writing up reports, and all five federal agencies wasting enormous amount of taxpayers' dollars to try to shut this guy down. Finally, the farmer said, he called his sheriff and said, "Sheriff, can you help me out at all?" The sheriff said, "I'll be over right away." So he went over, took a look at his farm, said, "There's nothing here that is any reason why. They just don't want you selling raw milk." So he wrote a letter to all five federal agencies and said, "You will not set foot on this farmer's property again. If you do so, you will be arrested and imprisoned for violating property rights." Amen. Brad Rogers, a hero. That's the kind of sheriffs we need to see freedom and liberty restored in America. And you can help, even if you're not of age to be elected a sheriff. You can help somebody running for sheriff, but be sure they're truly a constitutional sheriff. They've studied the Constitution, they know what it requires of them, and they're willing to follow through and do what is required of them. One last comment? Is there anyone else? One last comment? Okay, and then we'll... plenty of time? All right.
I was going to say that... they ever did, and the sheriff didn't know it, the guy could shoot him. He has the right to shoot him if he wants.
It's true. If they're trespassers, he ought to give them warning, leave the property, or else, I think shooting is the last thing you would want to do, only if they drew weapons, which the federal tyrants often are fully armed and, dangerous. Armed and dangerous. Federal employee, yeah. That's the case. So what we're sharing with you should encourage you to study the Constitution yourself, to learn it well enough to communicate it with other people, and most of all, to be involved in campaigns. You can get involved in a campaign in your local area for the election of a constitutional sheriff, and you can make a difference that you might think at your age you're not going to have much of an impact, but you can. My daughters have gone with me door to door, and I tell you, when they speak, people listen. We were at one place, a political event, where I was going to... there's a debate taking place. And they were just handing out literature to people as they were coming in. you know, saying, are you voting in the Democratic primary? And if they said yes, they handed him a piece of my literature. And one guy said, well, tell me, and he's speaking to Elizabeth, my 7-year-old, tell me why I should vote for your father. And she responded, because he believes in smaller, less taxing government. And the guy said, well, he's a Republican. He said, well, you almost tempt me to change parties and vote for your dad. So you can make an impact, and don't let your age discourage you from being involved in a level where you can make a large impact in our day.
Okay, real quick, your graphic, is that the Maryland State House?
That's the Maryland State House in the winter, and the oldest building that has been continuously used as a legislative body, 1760s or something like that, the oldest state house in America. Oh, yes, because people might think I've become a heretic running as a Democrat. We are in a county that's heavily Republican and a district that's heavily Republican. The Republican is always slated likely to win. But the Republican who's the incumbent is the one who voted for the rain tax with pleasure, the one who has done every kind of increase in taxation and increase in all kinds of programs. And so he's a Republican who has no physical constraints. He spends money freely. He's glad to spend the taxpayers' money. And on other things, he's unconstitutional, even though we have confronted him on his violations of the U.S. Constitution, the Maryland Constitution, and the Anne Arundel County Charter, all of which is refusal to say, well, I don't agree with you. You're wrong, and I'm right. And so it's like, if he wins the primary, which is happening next week on Tuesday, if he wins the primary, he needs an opponent to face him in the general election that will say he's wrong on this, he's wrong on this, he's a big spender and a big government man, and he needs an alternative to that. And so I'm running in the other party, which obviously if he wins his primary, there's only, you know, one other big box party that's going to be able to confront him. So they need an alternative. And I've talked with many Republicans who, if the incumbent wins the primary, would vote for me in the general because they recognize the party label is irrelevant, particularly at the local level. The party label's irrelevant. It's what the person stands for, what the person believes, what the person will do in terms of evaluating their character, what they will do when they are in office. And I think he's got enough weaknesses that even if he wins the primary, he's likely to go down in the general. However, if I wasn't running, my opponent in the primary, the other Democrat in the primary, is the exact opposite on everything I am. Smaller government, he's big government. More less taxes, he's big taxes. You know, sodomite on marriage and all the other evil things, he's fully in support of those. Gun grab in support of those. So all of the further leftist movement would happen in our county if I wasn't running as a Democrat and if the incumbent wins his primary. Things would just continue to go further left. And what we're doing here is being called skullduggery in the papers, and it's being called nefarious and underhanded, and all kinds of names are being thrown at us because, oh, how dare you do this, because my good friend Michael Peruca is running in the primary against the Republican. So the incumbent and him are faced off in the primary. If Michael wins and I win my primary, game over. Doesn't matter what happens in the general. So well, praise God.
One comment I would make is what you've done is an excellent job of what's known as political triangulation. It's an excellent strategy that we probably ought to have you and Barry Sheets get together and teach a class on, because it's a very wise strategy. You basically, you understand the old Tip O'Neill saying, all politics is local.
That's right.
And people don't care if the guy's right and he's doing something that everybody's mad about. It's a great political strategy to get yourself elected and in a position to do something about it. So I think it's a brilliant strategy.
In my state, a lot of the Democrats that they run Republicans so they can win.
Yes, and so the left has been using this same strategy for
forever years.
Yeah. And yet when we do it, oh man, the foaming at the mouth and the gnashing of teeth. Yep, it's very interesting to see the kind of responses we got, but you know, that's okay. We know that those leftists are mad because we're picking up on and following their strategy. Well, thank you so much for your attention. And I believe, we have 10 minutes? 10-minute break?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was Pastor David Whitney of the Institute on the Constitution and Cornerstone Evangelical Free Church. And his larger implications of the right to keep and bear arms and the right to self-defense. And we would ask that if you want to hear more of this, that you contact us here at the Institute for Principled Policy, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. If you want more information on videos of this presentation or to contact Pastor Whitney, you can contact us here or through Camp American, www.campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. And we'd ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.